Lee fought for Virginia. His mistake came, and I don't know that it was a mistake because it really was based on sound logic. If he were to end this war, or was going to end it, he had to make some offensive gesture toward the northern states. And as I said, the North had been humiliated at every incursion into the southern states. The Battle of Bull Run, two times the North was humiliated, and nearly every battle they fought, they just couldn't seem to get a hold of a victory. And Lee made a quick excursion into the North and was brought to a draw and had to withdraw his troops because he recognized the jeopardy he placed them in. The second time ended at Gettysburg, and Gettysburg was probably the turning point of the war. And Lee made a fatal mistake there by engaging the North at all. His most obvious choice should have been to go around them and to attack the capital. If he had, there's a lot of what ifs, you know, that could have changed the course of the war. Most historians feel if Lee had sidestepped Meade at Gettysburg and gone directly for Washington, D.C., you'd be living in the Confederacy right now rather than in the North, because he probably would have taken Washington without much trouble, and it's a whole lot easier to drive your enemy out of your nation's capital than it would be to defeat him on the fields of Gettysburg. Several other things were in play at an early stage in the war. France and England both backed the Confederacy. A lot of these things you don't hear a lot about in modern day explanations of the war for whatever reason. And France and England both backed the Confederacy and decided that the Confederacy's cause was just. And early in the year, I think it was about 1861, maybe beginning of 1862, a British ship called the Trent was seized by an American warship in national water, what now we would consider international waters, and the two Confederate commissioners were taken prisoner off of that boat. And you have to think for a minute about what's going on here. A federal warship, a United States warship, stops a British ship on the high seas and takes two men off of that ship. And if you remember anything about the War of 1812, that is exactly why we went to war with England. Because England, in its war with France, had begun to imprison American seamen from off of American ships. They felt it was their right to stop American ships and to take whatever and whoever they wanted off of those American ships. And we had gone to war with England in 1812 over that exact ideology. And now the American ships are stopping British ships and taking Confederate nationals off of the ship. And that became known as the Trent Incident. What happened as a result is the King of England sent immediately 9,000 British warriors or British soldiers into Canada with every intent of invading the North from the country of Canada. Another what if. If that had happened, you'd be living in the Confederacy right now, or else in the England restored colonies or whatever we would call them. But Lincoln, in a wise move, disclaimed the whole act as not right and not justifiable and released the two Confederate prisoners and basically restored some semblance of order there to the relations that the northern states had with the country of England. Another incident occurred when the British began to build warships for the Confederacy. And again, the British felt that the cause of the South was justifiable, and France did as well. England had a real stake in the matter. If you think back several, you know, years before, the United States had rebelled from against the authority of the English government and said, hey, we don't want your government. We, you know, reserve to ourselves the right to change our country and to remove ourselves from your jurisdiction. Now the South was doing the same thing to the North. And England said, hey, if you can secede from the English rule, why can't the southern states secede from the sovereignty that you claim to have? So they sided with them, began to build warships, and basically the North then threatened to go to war with England if they did not cease and desist from the manufacture of warships, and they kind of curbed the production of those ships. But the Obviously, across the great distance of the sea, the support of the English and the French began to wane as the war waxed on and on and on. The best strategy that the South had was to win a quick war. Of course, that was also the best strategy that the North had. Neither one of them succeeded in doing so, and when you're dealing across a barrier of several thousands of miles across an ocean, the interest of the English as well as the French just kind of waned and left the South hanging on their, you know, on their own benefits there to win the war, which they could not do. The battle at Chattanooga ended, and ended with a Union victory, and immediately General Sherman decided to make his fateful march to the sea, or and left Chattanooga and cut a path all the way across the South. His determination was to divide the South in half again. He had already cut the South this way by taking control of the Mississippi River. The states to the west of the Mississippi River that were part of the Confederacy were cut off. They couldn't do anything to really assist the cause of the South. Now he sought to cut this direction and cut two more sections across the South and further weaken them. It is at this point, as you begin to study the Civil War, that you're going to begin to uncover and to establish the hatred that probably still exists to this day between North and South. And you'll find it on both sides, but it was, I realized that all is fair in love and war, and when you begin to fight a war, things are going to happen that seem to be unfair. But when Sherman began his march to the sea, he cut a path 300 miles long, at least from Atlanta to Savannah, 300 miles long, 60 miles wide, and wrought devastation that took literally a decade for the South to undo. And his ideal was to destroy or to confiscate anything that could be deemed to be important militarily to the South, which really is a generic statement for take whatever you want. And his troops were guilty of massive looting. They took crops out of the fields, and what they couldn't confiscate or didn't want to confiscate as far as crops were concerned, they burned. They took livestock and cattle for the cause of the North. What they decided they could not take with them or did not want to take with them, they shot in the field and killed the cattle. When they came into an area, they burned any railroads or destroyed any railroads, burned any railroad junctions, which further cut off the transportation of the Southerners. Trying to think of what else they did. They burned cities. They burned any government building they could find. They burned warehouses. They burned all the factories they came in contact with. And again, you realize that facilitated the end of the war, certainly. But when the war was over, now you've got people in the South that are starving to death, that have no factories. They had very few to begin with. Now they have no factories. Their homes have been burned. Their farms have been looted and pillaged. And plus the fact you now have 3.5 million free black slaves that have no food, no homes, no jobs, and nowhere to go. And you begin to see what transpires in the South as a result of this war. But Sherman marches down through Atlanta, destroys Atlanta, and then moves on to Savannah, destroys Savannah, and marches up then through South Carolina and North Carolina, and General Johnston, who he was pursuing, surrenders at the end of April in 1865 near Durham, North Carolina. It's interesting that when Johnston surrenders the Confederate Army to General Sherman, the war has been over for about 10 days. The agreement that had Appomattox was signed. Anybody know when? Intelligent bunch of people, aren't we? When did the Civil War end? April the 9th, 1865, at Appomattox Courthouse, Lee and Grant had reached an agreement that by all estimations ended the cause of the Civil War. It was, I think it was April the 26th then, when Johnston surrendered to Sherman near Durham, North Carolina. So while the war was over, the war was still being fought. But the hatred in the South began to grow. As Sherman was cutting across the South, Grant decided it was time for him finally to take some offensive action that was going to work in the northeastern part near Richmond. The idea was to take Richmond. and the Union had failed on three or four different occasions to take Richmond. They had been humiliated there. Lee had driven them back every time, and Grant now takes the initiative and drives his troops, the Army of the Potomac, southward toward Richmond. It's called the Wilderness Campaign because if you have ever been in that area, it's very swampy, it's very desolate, and Grant charged through those swamps. He was determined to go through. The South took advantage of it. They put their sharpshooters and all of that in play, and by the time Grant had marched, I'm not sure how many miles, but I'm sure it's less than probably 100 miles from Washington down to Richmond. By the time they had covered that distance, the South had killed 55,000 Northern troops, just taking ambush and pot shots at them, and which made Grant even more furious. And when he finally got to Richmond, he bypassed Richmond and went south, and the little city of Petersburg there to the south of Richmond, he put a blockade around those two cities. He besieged those two cities and literally starved them out. And when Lee finally surrenders, I think he has 30,000 troops left. He's against, I think, the Federal Army number somewhere around 115,000 to 150,000 that Grant had left, and Lee was fighting them with 30,000 men and just realized the futility of such a move. And at Appomattox Courthouse near Richmond, April the 9th, 1865, Lee and Grant come to an agreement that is to end the Civil War. The war basically was fought with honor overall. There are some instances, as with Sherman, as we talked about, that were not honorable at all. Lee was an honorable man. Grant, for the most part, was an honorable man. The only questionable activity was the shelling of Vicksburg and the eradication of that town. I think they shelled that town for 6 weeks in order to get it to capitulate and to give up. But other than that, the war was a war with honor, and we talked about it before. It's an interesting reading, it's interesting history, because there was a motive or an element of Christianity involved in it that you see pervades the whole thing. These generals would get together and have coffee or tea the night before they go to battle. They had loved ones. I mean, some of them were married. Some of these men were brother-in-laws across lines, and they were married to sisters. Some of them were from the same hometown. Some of them were brothers. And on more than one occasion, before battle was fought, a Confederate general and a Northern general would exchange letters to their wives in case one or the other were killed. It was the other's responsibility to deliver that letter to the widow. And they were on opposing sides, but there was an element of honor involved in it. They were not fighting one another because they hated each other. They were fighting for principle. And in reality, the last war fought on principle was the Civil War. Everything else beyond that has been a war of, making a dollar, or a war of domination, a war of control, and in some cases even a war of defense. But this was a war of honor, and it ended honorably. When Grant and Lee reached an agreement, they allowed the officers to even retain their sidearms, and all of the men that served the Confederacy who had horses or mules that belonged to them, they were allowed to take them. They did not become property of the North. And again, to show you the contrast, while that's going on, Sherman is burning and killing and stealing all across the South. So you see the contrast even among the ideologies of the Northern generals. Grant was, for all practical points and purposes, a drunk, but he was a man of honor. And he had some things that Sherman lacked, and that's probably why he became president and Sherman never got very far. Sherman really committed some atrocities along the way, and it would cost him politically as well as in his own life later on. The war ends basically then on April the 9th, 1865. And Lee surrenders there to Grant. As I said before, 17 days later, Johnston surrenders the rest of the Southern Army to Sherman near Durham, North Carolina. In the interim, between April the 9th and April the 26th, another event occurred that was forever changed the course of this nation. And that, of course, was the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, April the 15th, 1865. And Lincoln really never lived to see the end of the war. I mean, the surrender had taken place about a week prior, and from what we understand, he had gotten word and knew that the surrender had occurred, but Sherman and Johnson were still duking it out down in the Carolinas. And the surrender of 30,000 enemy troops does not necessarily mean the war is over. We know now that it did. Okay, we understand now that when Lee surrendered, he was surrendering on behalf of the Confederacy. But a week later, there's no way to make that determination, especially while the largest majority of Southern troops are still actively engaged in warfare. So Lincoln probably never knew that the war was officially over. And Lincoln was shot at Ford Theater in Washington, D.C. By John Wilkes Booth. It is a very interesting note to realize some things that went on during the course of all that was concerned. There was another religious organization that backed the cause of the South during the Civil War, and that was the Roman Catholic Church. They supported the Southern endeavors, and you know, not to their credit or discredit, but certainly just a statement of fact. An interesting piece of reading that you could probably do if you care to read any further on this, a book called 50 Years in the Church of Rome. 50 Years in the Church of Rome is an autobiography written by a man by the name of Father Chiniquy. Father Chiniquy was a Roman Catholic Jesuit priest for 50 years before he was converted to Christ and left the church. And when he did, he had some interesting documents and some interesting letters that he released and published, and 50 Years in the Church of Rome is his autobiography. In that, he states, I cannot remember exactly, but it was at least 2 to 3 or 4 days prior to the assassination, he stated that a traveling Jesuit stopped in at his parish somewhere in Wisconsin and told him that Lincoln had been assassinated. And when he asked him about it, the fellow backed off and said, no, he hadn't been, but he was going to be. And he documented all that. It's in his book. And the statement was that he was going to be assassinated. Another interesting factor is that John Wilkes Booth was a Roman Catholic, was raised Roman Catholic and lived Roman Catholic. Now, I don't mean that that's... I'm not trying to make any implications. I'm just giving you some interesting coincidences. As a matter of fact, 8 people were hanged in the conspiracy. If you remember, Mary Surratt and those, all 8 of them were Roman Catholics. None of them were of any religious background other than Roman Catholic. And for years, there was a theory that Booth even got away, and there was an individual shot in a farmhouse, and there was much disagreement over whether that was actually John Wilkes Booth or not. The fellow that was identified, if you look at the autopsy reports, and of course in those days they were rather sketchy, but the body that they brought out and turned in as John Wilkes Booth had a reddish, had red hair and red beard, and John Wilkes Booth had coal black hair and a black beard. And so there was a doubt as to whether it was Booth at all. Some even state that the wrong leg was broken. The witnesses at Ford Theater stated, I believe it was the right leg that had been broken when the fellow jumped from the balcony. The body that was turned in as Wilkes Booth had a broken left leg. And so it was never really determined with any accuracy whether Booth died or not. Not that it's important. I'm sure that he's dead now. Okay. I don't believe he's still alive, but what happened was, for whatever reason, Lincoln was assassinated. The question, of course, is why? Lincoln had manifested himself as an able leader in the country. He had sought from the very beginning of the war to maintain the unity of the Union or the nation, and he had done so. He really, to be honest with you, the idea of slavery is a little bit portrayed a little bit differently in the history of the Civil War than what you and I would like to believe we've been taught about it. Lincoln never intended to set the slaves free. You can find it in his own quote. That was not his intention. His intention was to preserve the Union. Slavery became the trump card. And as the North tried to inflict further and further penalties on the South, they did so with increasingly different techniques, and the Emancipation Proclamation was one of those techniques. You'll find the Emancipation Proclamation did not eliminate slavery, contrary to popular belief. It set free every slave who was engaged in war against the Union. That's exactly what the proclamation stated. Any southern state that had slaves, the Emancipation Proclamation set those slaves free. Did not set free any slaves that existed in Union territory or in states that were slave states and yet they had not sided with the South, like Delaware and Kentucky, and those places had nothing to do with the slaves in those states. And so the Emancipation Proclamation was literally a war move. It was an effort to further cripple the South. And the 13th Amendment is what finally freed the slaves. And that was passed there long after the Emancipation Proclamation. But Lincoln is shot. Some believe it was because of the Emancipation Proclamation. But again, if it was, it was an act of war. Because he was at war with the southern states, and that's exactly what the Emancipation Proclamation had done. It had been an attack on the South. And if that was what resulted in his assassination, then it was an act of war. It was no more than a soldier shooting another soldier. And even though Lee had surrendered, the war was not officially over for Johnston and his men. So if that were the case, then Lincoln was not assassinated for any principle or any value he held. He was a casualty of war. If, however, Lincoln was assassinated because of what he intended to do following the war, then you have some very difficult situations. There are some writings in existence in which Lincoln made the statement that the most dangerous threat to American sovereignty beyond the South and their secession was the power of the Roman Catholic Church and the papacy. Lincoln made that statement. And Lincoln had intended to take action against the Roman Catholic Church following the end of the Civil War. And if that be true, again, I'm giving you one alternative. If that be true, then Lincoln was assassinated to keep him from doing any damage to the papacy in the United States of America. And again, the facts drop in line. And I'm not saying that that's exactly what happened. I don't know. I just know somebody shot him. And but Lincoln had done that. For whatever reason, Lincoln is assassinated. Lincoln is killed. It comes as a devastating blow to the North and even to the South. And it would cause the suffering of both sides. Over the next 10 to 12 years, both sides would suffer because Lincoln was assassinated. Lincoln had begun from the very first days of the war producing what he called his plan of Reconstruction. And to reconstruct the Union. Lincoln's plan of reconstruction, to be honest with you, was very lenient, very tolerant, and would probably have resulted in everything being over with and done within just a couple of years. And Lincoln, of course, being assassinated, put an end to that. His idea was, number one, to transport the slaves that had been brought to America back to their homeland. The nation of Liberia had been founded in Africa as early as the days of Madison and Monroe because there was a general consensus in America that slavery was wrong. I mentioned to you the fact that at the beginning of the Civil War, there are only 6,000 plantation owners. There are 6,000 people in America that would claim that slavery was a justifiable institution. There were people caught in the middle who, like I've told you before, had the opinion that slavery was wrong, but to rid ourselves of it right now drastically would cost our economy. Madison, Monroe, Jefferson, Washington, and all of those men felt that way. Slavery was an institution that had to be dealt with, but it had to be dealt with slowly because it had become such a part of the economical life of America. Liberia had been established in the days of Monroe as a free, sovereign, independent country in Africa where freedmen and slaves were allowed to be returned to their country and set up their own nation. The Constitution of Liberia very strongly resembles that of the United States of America. As a matter of fact, the capital of Liberia, does anybody know what the name of the capital is? Bunch of intelligent people, aren't we? It's Monrovia. Monrovia is the capital of Liberia. If you want to know where it gets its name from President Monroe, who created the country and allowed the slaves to return. Now think for a minute. That sounds real drastic today. You know, you hear people say, well, let's pack them all up and send them back. Those people there are as much American as you are. They were born here, their grandparents were born here, and their great-grandparents were born here. But following the close of Civil War, some of those people had only been out of Africa for 20 years, 15 years. And the desire they had would have been to go home again. They still had family in a lot of cases in Africa. And so the idea was to allow them to be returned to their own country. Lincoln and Johnson both opposed citizenship for slaves. Both of them did. Johnson vetoed the bill that would have given them civil rights under the protection of the United States Constitution. He was the successor to Abraham Lincoln. And the idea was to send them back to their country, to their native country, not because they didn't want them to be here. See, again, you and I try to interpret history from where we are, which is called rewriting history. From their standpoint, they felt it an immorality to take people who'd been pulled out of their land and keep them here, even by making them citizens. They felt it immoral to offer them anything to make it appealing to stay here when their own country and family was across the sea. And so the idea of Lincoln was to grant them transportation back to their country, to allow them to set up their own independent nations there, to help them in whatever way was necessary. His ideal was what was called the 10% plan. And under a 10% plan, when a state in the South, 10% of its people swore an oath or an allegiance back to the Union, or 10% of the white males. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. I have been struggling. Shall take a drink. When 10% of the voting white males in the South swore an allegiance to the North, they were allowed to reinstitute their government, re-enter the Union. Lincoln felt that none of the states of the South had ever really seceded from the Union. Now here's the important factor, see. Did they really secede or didn't they? You say, why is that important? Because if they really did secede from the Union, Lincoln is not authorized to pardon them. Because they ceased to be American citizens. They ceased to be American states. And at that point, it is not the president's authority to allow them re-entry into the Union. It is Congress. And there's where your battle now begins to wage for the next few years. Lincoln had always stated and always maintained that because of the authority of the Constitution, a state could not secede from the Union. Therefore, even though they said they did, they voted to do it, they constitutionally were denied that right, therefore everything they did was null and void. And as such, they were just in open rebellion against the authority of their own country. And at the close of the Civil War, it was his idea to bring them back in by pardoning them and allowing them reentry. So his plan for Reconstruction was really basically very simple. Johnson, upon the assassination of Lincoln, attempted to follow suit. Several things were not in his favor, and the number one, he was a Democrat. Lincoln was a Republican. And that was back in the days when partisanship really didn't matter a whole lot. Men would run for the same office or run together, even though they were of different political philosophies. And Johnson and Lincoln had run together, been elected. Johnson was a Democrat. Not only that, but he was from Tennessee. What do you know about Tennessee? It was a southern state. Johnson had been opposed to the secession from the Union, and when Tennessee had seceded from the Union, Johnson had basically seceded from Tennessee. And he was a northern sympathizer as far as his philosophy was concerned, and he was the vice president of Abraham Lincoln then. But upon Lincoln's assassination, now you have a southerner in the White House. You see the problems? The South has just been defeated. But you now have a southerner in the White House. And although he had renounced the activities of Tennessee, he had renounced the activities of the Confederacy, nonetheless, he was still a southerner. And when he was placed in office, his desire was to continue Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction. But the difference was, he was not Lincoln. He had not been elected president by the people of the nation, and he was a Democrat from the South. And because of that, he immediately was besieged with problems in his administration. I mentioned to you the fact that when Johnson was put in power, Lincoln had offered already the 10% plan to reintroduce states into the Union. By the time Lincoln is shot, I mean, the war has just been over about a week, theoretically, with the surrender of Grant, our surrender of Lee to Grant, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee have already met the requirements and been readmitted into the Union under Lincoln's plan, which reinstituted all of their rights as citizens, the whole deal. And when Johnson comes into power, he seeks to keep that thing running. And the Wade-Davis bill is passed, or it seeks to be passed by Congress. And Congress now states that no, the South did not just think they seceded from the Union. They literally had seceded from the Union. And as such, it was not within the scope of the president to allow them to come back in under any provision or policy. It was the job of the Congress. Now then, the Congress passes the Wade-Davis bill, and Lincoln pocket vetoes this bill just before his assassination. But the Wade-Davis bill stated that in order for a state to come back into the Union, the majority of the voting populace of that state had to take an oath of loyalty to the Union, and certain Southern Confederate officers and officials were never allowed to hold office again in those states. They were never allowed to be in office or political power. That was what the Congress was after. And Lincoln pocket vetoes that bill, that legislation. What's a pocket veto? I'm asking the wrong questions this morning, aren't I? Anybody know what a pocket veto is? He doesn't sign it. It goes to his office, but Lincoln knew that Congress's session was about to adjourn. They were about to go home. They were finished. And a pocket veto means he just lets it lay there, and they adjourn without anything ever happening. And so that legislation is pocket vetoed. Lincoln is then assassinated. Johnson comes into power. Now then, here is a Southerner sympathizing in the eyes of Congress with the South, because he favors Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction. And Congress immediately goes to work on him. They vote in the 14th Amendment. The 13th and the 14th Amendment basically are placed in. The 13th Amendment frees the slaves. The 14th Amendment makes them citizens. And again, to get an idea of what was going on here, you were not dealing with a massive hatred of blacks. Okay, when you think of the South now and you think of the relationship between Southerners and blacks, basically, if you're from the North, you have a very distorted view. Things that went on in the South that nobody would ever, could ever justify. The blacks as a race were mistreated in the South. And for the last 20 years, they've been mistreated in Washington. And they've been manipulated more in the last 20 years by the Congress of the United States than they ever were by Southern plantation owners. And they've been manipulated into the, we've got them all corralled in the inner cities now. We've got them all living on government income now. They still are under slavery. The master's just changed. And if you don't believe that, go check them out. That's what's going on. When the South was opened its doors and the blacks were free, now remember, Sherman has just marched through the South and left the South totally decimated. There were Southerners starving to death, literally starving to death at the close of the Civil War. The crops had been burned. The fields had been torn all to pieces. The cities have been burned. Their courthouses have been burned. With your courthouse goes all your documents and records. Who owns the land and what did they pay for that? Everything's gone. The plantation houses have been destroyed. People have sent sons and fathers off to war, and now they're finding out those people have been killed. And now the widow is supposed to inherit the land, but she doesn't have any documentation that her husband ever owned any land because the courthouse has been burned. And you're talking about anarchy existing in the South. Now add to that that with the passage of the 13th and 14th Amendments, 3.5 million people are added to the citizenship of the United States. What does that mean? That's not 3.5 million people in the North. That's 3.5 million people in the South are added citizen or given citizenship in the United States, which means they have civil rights, they have rights that everybody else has. However, they have no land, they have no food, they have no jobs, they don't even have a house. Booker T. Washington was a great leader of his people, and he wrote about the stories that he was told when the slaves were freed. He talked about the joy. They were called up to the big house, and a federal officer was there and read to them the fact that they were free. And he talked about the grandmas weeping and crying and the grandpas crying because they knew what it was to be taken out of their own country. And there was a great amount of joy. But he said by the time they had returned from the big house down to where they lived, the people were crying now because they began to realize they didn't have a home anymore. And they didn't have anything. They had no money, they had no food, they had no home, they were free. And you kind of get an idea of what the Russians have gone through in the last couple of years. You know, freedom is a great word. But if you don't have any food or any money or any house, what good is freedom? And so there's a lot of turmoil with the blacks in the South. There's a lot of turmoil with the whites in the South. And Congress then attempts to, because Johnson failed to act, he voted down or vetoed two pieces of legislation. One was the Freedmen's Bill. And under the Freedmen's Bill, they were all to be made citizens of the United States. That goes down because Johnson vetoes it. That was prior to the amendment being passed. And they attempted to do it through legislation. He vetoed that bill. He also vetoed a bill that would have given them all civil rights equal to any white in America. That was opposed by the President of the United States. And not for racial reasons, because their ideal at that time was let's send them back to their homeland. Let's allow them to go home. Let's not take any moves here to make them part of this society. Let's send them back. As a matter of fact, I could read you some statements by Lincoln that would instigate a racial war in this day and time. You know, a lot of what we hear about history is just rewritten history. And Lincoln did not believe that it was the intent of God for them to ever have citizenship in America, and made such a statement on several occasions. Johnson vetoes those two pieces of legislation. Congress counterattacks with an impeachment process against Andrew Johnson. And there was a long list of atrocities that Johnson was guilty of, and a long list of crimes he had committed. The main one that they were after was the fact he had violated a policy Congress had placed in power, which stated that a president could not fire anybody unless he asked Congress first. And Johnson had removed Stanton from office, who was the Secretary, I think, of War, and had fired Edward Stanton, and Congress said, you can't do that, and they sought to impeach him. And you know as well as I do that the impeachment didn't work. It missed by one vote shy of impeaching the President of the United States, and Johnson remained in power. However, it had kind of plucked his feathers, so to speak. He was not to soar as high as he could have soared, perhaps, because of that venture. Congress then passes the Reconstruction Act of 1867. And here's where you're hatred. Now you take Sherman's just marched through the South. He has destroyed the South. 3.5 million blacks have now been set free in the South. The Union has done nothing to feed them. It has done nothing to clothe them, done nothing to help other than establish a freedmen's society, which was established kind of like the Red Cross to give them clothing. And again, think about it, the Freedmen's Society was giving clothing, and in some cases food, to the black slaves while the white Southerners were starving out. And they were not allowed to obtain any help because the society was organized for Congress to help the slaves. Not that that was wrong, but I'm trying to get you to see it through the eyes of the Southerner. And the 3.5 million blacks have now become the burden of the South to take care of. The Union, in all fairness, the Union's economy is destroyed. They have pumped literally thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars into this war effort, and several things have taken place that was to totally change this country forever beyond the death of Abraham Lincoln. Number one, the United States stopped issuing its currency in gold or silver. It introduced what's called a Federal Reserve Note, a greenback. That's what you got in your pocket today. What you have in your pocket today is not money. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. That is not money. It is legal tender. It is not money. You look right on the top of that, it said Federal Reserve Note. What that is an IOU. That's all you're carrying in your pocket this morning is a federal IOU. And what that states is that we promise to pay $1 if you'll exchange this piece of paper. And up to that point, you dealt in gold and silver. It's an interesting thought. You think about it. I mentioned this to somebody else. When Henry Ford manufactured his first automobile, you could buy a brand new car for $1,200. It was a brand new automobile. And here we are, far removed from that. But did you know today that we were on the gold standard at that time? And your money was backed by gold. The United States no longer backs its money with gold. I mean, they issued a greenback and they backed it with gold and then they backed it with silver. And I really don't think it's backed at all today. I think this note, last time I checked, was worth about 7 cents in literal gold. That's what it's worth. But today, if you had $1,200 in gold coins, you could go down here to the car dealer and buy a brand new Lincoln Continental and drive it home for $1,200. So the economy hadn't changed a whole lot when you consider gold. A new car today is still worth $1,200 in gold. The difference is these things here are worthless. That's why you have to go in and present $25,000 to $35,000 of these in order to get an automobile, when $1,200 in gold would do it. But for the first time in the history of America, America began to issue greenbacks. While the greenbacks did not fare real well, as you and I well know, neither did the Confederate money. The Confederates issued their own promissory notes, called Confederate notes. And, of course, the problem with this right here, these greenbacks, is inflation controls the greenbacks. Gold isn't controlled by inflation. People say, well, we don't want gold. Gold can't be touched by inflation. Gold is worth what gold is worth. And as the South issued their Confederate money, when they began to lose, it became obvious they were going to lose the war. You know what happened to the value of their currency? Nosedived. Did you know before the close of the Civil War that breakfast for three people in Richmond, Virginia cost over $140? A pair of shoes in the South could be bought for $200. You know why? The value of their currency wasn't any good. Because the government backing the currency was faulty. Now, you know what? You could easily go to dinner in some of the finest restaurants in this town, and dinner for three in Toledo could cost you 140 of these. And I'll bet you've seen shoes for $200. What happened? Do we use any more leather now than we used to use to make shoes? No. Do we eat any differently now than we used to eat? No, same food. What has made it go from $3 for a pair of shoes to $200? The institution backing these greenbacks is faulty. And your greenbacks aren't any good. Where did that come from? It came from the Civil War. Something else came during the Civil War you're probably not aware of was a draft in the military. The first draft system instituted in the United States of America was instituted during the Civil War. You didn't have a chance to decide whether you wanted to fight or not. You had to go fight. And you became property of the country in which you resided. They could tell you whether you were supposed to fight or not. I'm not opposed to fighting for your country. I'm not necessarily opposed to a draft. I don't favor it. I think that every male ought to be made to serve 2 years in the military regardless. I believe that. I'm kind of afraid of, I think it was Andy Rooney just wrote a book called My War, was a war correspondent, it's a good book. He said, I'm afraid when a nation has to rely on people they've drafted to defend their country. That's a strange thought. Everybody ought to have to serve in their country. Jerusalem and Israel does that. If you grow up in Italy, as a matter of fact, our missionaries, the Masveris kids, are coming home. One of the reasons, I'm sure, is if Jake stayed in Italy, he would have to serve in the Italian army. I mean, you're there in the country. You're a part of that country. They are citizens of Italy, and as such, you have to serve in the military. Israel's that way. Greece is that way. Nearly every country but us is that way. It's a mandatory thing. But the draft was instituted during the Civil War, and one of the little tidbit you might be aware of and might not be aware of is that our new system of voluntary income tax. And if you don't believe that, read the first page of your 1995 or 1994 income tax, and it tells you right there this is voluntary. You either volunteer to do it or you go to jail, one of the two. But that was instituted during the Civil War. And those things have been passed down from successive generations. So what the Union was about changed as well. The South now is free. Congress assumes control of Reconstruction. And when Congress does, they have a very different ideology than what Lincoln and Johnson have. For instance, when Congress reconvenes, because of Lincoln's 10% policy, now sitting in the hallowed halls of Congress are some of these same Confederate ideology fellas that were there before the war started. And these congressmen just cannot tolerate the fact that these secessionists are back in Congress. And so they immediately passed the 13th and then the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, the Constitution of the United States, states that certain people who are sympathizers or part of the Confederacy can never hold office again, and what you now have is Congress officially taking the rights of Southerners that are whites to vote away. You've got people in the South now that can't vote because of 1867, the Reconstruction Act, and the 14th Amendment. Now let's go back and look at it again. Sherman has marched to the sea and destroyed the economy of the South. The people of the South are starving at the close of the Civil War, literally starving. It would take them at least 10 years to rebuild what's been destroyed in their country. Now you've got 3.5 million starving people added to those lists that are granted full privileges under the Constitution. Now they are given the right to vote. Plus, Southerners have lost their right to vote because of the Reconstruction Act of 1867. Now, let me ask you, what's going to happen in a situation like that? Is that going to lend itself to peaceful coexistence with the North? There's a hatred that exists there. There is a hatred that exists, and still exists there to this day. And if you don't believe it, you get down to some of the deep parts of Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, and you'll find it there just as real as it ever was. And there are people in Georgia fixing to go to war over the stars and bars that fly over the Georgia state flag. And you can say it's racist all you want, but it's all those people have left of their pride and dignity after what was done to them following the Civil War. And they're starving. They're hungry. And they've lost their right to vote. Now then, one of the things that citizenship does is give you the rights under the Constitution, the civil rights of America. What is the Second Amendment to the Constitution state? What is it? The right to keep and bear arms. If you're a citizen of America, you can now keep and bear arms, right? Unless you're a Southern white who just finished out the Civil War, because you're not allowed to carry a weapon now, because the Congress now has decided what Lee did, or what Grant did, what Lincoln did, and what Johnson did, that's not good. We can't just let these people have guns, so we're going to restrict their right to keep and bear arms. But we've got 3.5 million starving black people that are now citizens of the United States. They're given the right to carry guns. Now I add another problem to the pot. Carpetbaggers. Carpetbaggers were people basically from the North. The term carpetbag, we carry a briefcase. Okay, in those days they carried a carpet bag with all their official papers in it. And at the end of the Civil War, the Reconstruction Act of 1867 divided the South into 5 military districts governed by military commanders. It was a police state. And these carpetbaggers were sent back in. They were solicited from the North. We want you to go back in and help rebuild the South. Well, the idea was you go down there and invest. You can do whatever you want to do. We just want to help. Well, these guys saw an opportunity, and they rushed off to the south. And basically what they did, they used the fact that there were no existing documents, there were no deeds, and they literally took control. They had a new group that were easily influenced. You had 3.5 million blacks that were hungry. They were illiterate. They couldn't read. They couldn't write. They didn't know anything about government, and all they wanted was a meal. And a carpetbagger with a little money in just a short period of time could buy all the votes he needed to totally change the complexion of any government in the South and make himself, you know, put himself in an advantageous position. And if you read the history of the carpetbaggers, they got to the place where even the Northerners hated them because of what they had done. Add one more element, scallywags. Carpetbaggers and scallywags. Scallywags were Southerners who were sympathetic to the North and had enough left after the Civil War to see an opportunity to make something great for themselves. And they took advantage of the chaos in the South. So from the Northern counterpart, you got the carpetbaggers. The same thing in the South would be called a scallywag. And before long, legislation was being passed that took land away from people, that denied them the right to farm their own land, right down the line. And what do you do? Well, you bring in two groups, and those two groups, one of them is called the Knights of the White Camellia. Okay, you probably never heard of them, but the other one you've heard of, called the Ku Klux Klan. And the Ku Klux Klan and the Knights of White Camellia were both instituted as a repercussion to what the carpetbaggers and the scallywags and basically the Congress of the United States was doing in the South. I'm not here to justify the Ku Klux Klan, okay? I am not a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I am opposed to what the Ku Klux Klan stands for overall. But not to worry, I'm opposed to unions. Okay? I don't agree with anything. There's not one union worth its salt in this nation. Okay? If I was left up to me, I'd make them all illegal. If you're a member one, if you have to be, that's one thing. But if you're a voluntary member of a union, God have mercy on you. You just haven't got any good sense. You say, well, you know, think about it. We had to have the unions, and I know I've read all this stuff. We had to have unions because we were working too many hours, and we were working in dangerous, dangerous conditions. It's the two main arguments of the unions back in the 30s. So today we got the unions in place. And you probably pay them somewhere between $100 and $200 a month to belong, and you have to work mandatory overtime, and OSHA cites more violations in industry in the United States now than ever before in the history of this nation. So your unions are liars. And you're paying them $200 a month to buy big fancy homes and drive big fancy automobiles and link up with organized crime and basically undergird everything this country's about. How's that for unions? They won't like me, will they? I have an uncle that's a union representative, or was, and it doesn't matter to me. I feel the same way about them, though, that I felt about the Ku Klux Klan. At the time they were brought in, something had to be done. I do not justify the union's existence today. I think the time of the union is gone. I think the time of the Ku Klux Klan is gone. At the time they were brought in, if you look at the circumstances around which they were introduced, something had to be done. I think the Ku Klux Klan and the Knights of the White Camellia were probably the best thing that the people of that time in that locality could come up with, just like the trade unions. But you fueled a fire in the South. And a lot of the things that happened in the South, and literally, I mean literally, you have restaurants where blacks were not allowed to eat. You had places where blacks were not allowed to go into the restrooms used by the white people. You had situations, but those things were not in place, by and large, before the Civil War. Before the Civil War, you know where black people went to church? They went to white churches. You had a fully integrated religious system in the South prior to the Civil War. You want to know where the separation came? It came after the Civil War, during the Reconstruction, when Southerners got mad as they could get. And they said, we're not going to have this. And a lot of what was termed racism, and rightly was racial, in the South, was not a result of Southerners hating blacks. It was a result of Southerners hating the way they were treated during Reconstruction. And still isn't over. It's still isn't over. I mean, I've been in places down there, you know, where the South Shall Rise Again stickers are all over the place, and the stars and bars are flying, and guy's got a little hat on, says American by birth and Southern by the grace of God, you know, that kind of thing. It's a different situation. And that's what brought you through to about 1867, 1868, 1869. This country almost ceased to exist from within. And the carpetbaggers and the Congress almost did to this nation what the South and the North couldn't do during the Civil War. They almost destroyed it. And the idea then was vengeance, vengeance, vengeance. While the war had been fought with honor, the Reconstruction was put in place with vengeance. And it just didn't work well.